Now stay tuned for Biographies in Sound on NBC.
I was told that he was once invited to one of those dinners given by organizations in which there are endless speeches. And naturally, like most of us, he wanted to duck that one. And he refused several times, and they wouldn't take no. And finally, the last letter importuning him to appear, he answered with a telegram and said, "I wish I wanted to come to your dinner, but I don't."
The National Broadcasting Company presents Mr. John, The Golden Story, another in a series of Biographies in Sound. Within the next 55 transcribed minutes, the voices of Dorothy McGuire, George Abbott, Victor Borge, Elliot Nugent, Helen Hayes, and others, sketching the portrait of a man whose dream it was to bring back the living drama to its place under the sun. Producer, playwright, composer, and for decades the patriarch of show business, John Golden. Your narrator is Kenneth Banghart.
Along the phenomenon that is known loosely as Broadway, they called him a plutocratic Peter Pan, this man who never grew up in the best sense of the words, who refused to live in the past, but at the same time personified the traditions of the old school. Birth date, June 27, 1874, in New York City. The boy Golden, stage-struck from infancy, went to work as a bricklayer in the daytime and then rushed over to Niblo's garden to appear in a super spectacle of the Roman Empire, changing his bricklayer's garb for a toga before reaching for a spear. "We dressed in a cellar," he recalled, and by we, he meant himself and 99 dilapidated derelicts who had drifted in from the Bowery to turn thespians at 25 cents per evening. The boy Golden was determined to learn his drama from the inside. That's how it began, this Golden success story. And among its chapter headings are the names of some of the outstanding plays of the last 40 years, beginning with Turn to the Right, and including Susan and God, Three's a Family, and Claudia. And the man, John Golden?
There was a massiveness about him.
Dorothy McGuire.
His face was large and kind, with penetrating eyes. He had a way of tilting his head to one side and fixing his eyes upon you and looking right into you. His voice was loud and bombast, the loud voice of a man who has energy and optimism. And one knew that one was in the presence of a very important man.
On the same subject, producer Richard Aldrich.
He was a very determined man. Those who worked with him were expected to carry out his wishes to the letter. But he had the right to expect his own way, because he had earned that right. He knew what he was doing, and those who worked with him were well aware of it. Mr. John was a gruff but generous man. He was an impatient but vital man. He had a terrific amount of energy, and his bark was worse than his bite.
And the impressions of Miss Cornelia Otis Skinner.
I myself shall never go into Sardi's restaurant without seeing John Golden sitting there in the back at his special big hospitable table, surrounded by his daily luncheon guests, which included people in show business, people in public life, members of the UN, sometimes the mayor, every mayor from Mayor LaGuardia to Mayor Wagner, sometimes Mrs. Roosevelt. John at the head of the table, holding forth on 1,001 topics, interrupting himself to catch the hand of a passing friend or to blow a kiss to a pretty woman across the room. It's a warm picture, one to treasure. And it makes me realize the truth of the saying that to live in hearts we leave behind is not to die.
This, then, was one aspect of the personality of John Golden, but only one. Claudia, the comedy, opened on Broadway in February of 1941, played two long engagements, and then went on the road with several companies. Box office receipts, more than $3 million. Motion picture rights, $137,000. John Golden used to say that one of the greatest joys of being a producer was picking up stars, locating those who hadn't yet found their place in the theater, and providing them with a vehicle for getting to the top. And usually, credit for the discovery and exploitation of the stuff stars are made of could be chalked up to him alone. But there was one case where the credit pie was cut into quarters.
The first time I met John Golden, I stood in his very large office in the St. James Theater building, with the sunlight of 44th Street filtering through the windows.
Dorothy McGuire, remembering.
At the end of that long room was a great large desk, and behind the desk was a door that opened upon his own private barber shop, and beyond that was an inner office. The personality of John Golden needed a lot of room. He brought me into his office to introduce me to a friend of his, the late Commissioner Carey of New York City. The conversation went something like this. Well, Jim, what do you think of my new star? And then he and Jim stood back about 10 or 12 feet from me and circled about me. I felt somewhat as if I were a filly in a paddock. And then John said, she stands like a good racehorse, doesn't she? And so it was that I felt the appraising eye of a man who had appraised many artists.
That's account number one, and it's not altogether in accord with the owner of another appraising eye, John Golden's barber, Joe Lapomo.
When they were casting Claudia, I walked in just at the time when he was interviewing Dorothy McGuire and another actress. After the interview, he says to me, which one do you prefer? Well, I says, Dorothy McGuire, a prettier girl than the other girl. Of course, they cast Dorothy McGuire, and it was a terrific hit.
Version number two, followed closely by still another eyewitness, Vincent Sardi.
This was when I had first started working in the restaurant, and I was very much in awe of Mr. Golden at that time. And he called me over to the table one day and looked at me rather ferociously. I thought he was going to scold me for something or other a waiter had done. And finally looked at me and he says, yes, he says, you're pretty young. He said, you must know who the young actresses are that are around now. He said, I don't know any more of the young ones. I know all the old ones. He said, we're casting a show now, and we're looking for a nice young actress to play the part of Claudia. Well, frankly, I'd never read the book. Never heard of Claudia, didn't know exactly what he was talking about, but he had me so scared, I looked up in the lobby, and there was standing a nice young actress called Dorothy McGuire. And I said, why, there's Dorothy McGuire. She ought to play the part, and sure enough, she did.
It's difficult to say how many other armchair talent scouts are proudly claiming the distinction of discovering Miss McGuire. Certainly, John Golden was not willing to take a bow for that accomplishment.
It happened that Rose Franken liked her looks. Johnny Craven, my godson, pointed to her and said I was in a cast with that girl and she was great. You ought to give her a chance, Uncle John. Rose Franken liked her, took her up to her country place, worked on her for a week or two, came down to me and said, we've got a genius, we've got a great little star. And so, the next thing I know, there was a little girl playing Claudia in Rose Franken's play, Claudia, and I had a successful play, and that's how I became a great producer.
But the great producer also committed a number of what might be politely termed major goofs. Errors in judgment that he later was fond of recalling. Not all the youngsters who came to his office asking for a break were recognized for their potentialities.
When I produced Seventh Heaven originally, I had a good little girl by the name of Catherine Cornell in it. I let Catherine Cornell go. I let Catherine Hepburn go. I let worse than that go. I had Spencer Tracy and fired him out of a part and gave it to Frank Craven. I've made more mistakes. I played some funny little show with a star. The star was Leo Carrillo. And about the third act, a small actor came out on the stage. He was a general in the Mexican army. And he had a few lines and a glare and a pop in his voice that made the audience sit up straight, straighten their backs and stare at this new thing. And I didn't know enough to keep him. I'll tell you his initials, Edward G. Robinson.
The list of those who were told by Golden they just didn't have it does not end there. It goes on to a name that became a synonym for America's matinee idol.
I had written a musical comedy called The Candy Shop. And the young juvenile in that thing was a fresh young monkey by the name of John Barrymore. Well, he was bouncing around there, chasing the girls all over the boardwalk down Atlantic City. And my best friend was a fellow named Winchell Smith, who subsequently became my partner. And he had written a play called The Fortune Hunter. But they wanted a leading man.
Now, I had this fellow Barrymore in my company. But sometimes I'd call a rehearsal and little Jackie wouldn't be there. He would go out of the Apollo Theater in Atlantic City, out of the boardwalk, in a wheelchair with two chorus girls in the company and say, just go A-W-O-L, and I just wait there to rehearse those two chorus girls and Mr. Barrymore till they got darn good and ready to come back. Well, when Winchell Smith read me his play, The Fortune Hunter, I said, that Barrymore boy would be grand for that part. I really meant that. Two, I was glad to get rid of him.
But enough about the Golden mistakes. If his hits had not greatly outweighed them, John Golden would have had difficulty becoming one of the few Broadway producers who accumulated a substantial fortune. The embryonic plans for that fortune, incidentally, started with chewing gum in the days that John was constantly fighting with the law of self-preservation, a young actor in Manhattan resting between engagements. When a chewing gum manufacturer offered him a job, Golden jumped at the chance to make 15 cents commission on the sale of a jar of chewing gum. But in addition to peddling it, Golden experimented with a new flavor, essence of cloves chewing gum, and it sold. Various cafes putting the new type of gum in bowls with a sign underneath reading, "Have one," and Golden's job was to keep the bowls filled. But alas, the very popularity of the product was its downfall. Men would stop and fill their pockets, and just when it looked as though Golden and clove chewing gum were reaching the apex of success, the bar owners realized they were giving away 11 cents worth of gum with every 10 cent drink. The chewing gum experience, however, led to his meeting a man who, Golden said, had more effect on the course of his life than anyone else. His name was Francis J. Oakes, and he was president of the Oakes Chemical Company. Golden was 21 years old when he went to work for Oakes as a salesman. 2 years later, he was made president and general manager. He stayed with the company for 13 years, but business couldn't hold him. "When I figured I'd put by enough money so I wouldn't have to worry about meals," he said, "I lost no time in getting back to my true love." That chance came when he was 34. He wrote lyrics for 4 consecutive Hippodrome shows. They were nothing to brag about, he later admitted, and he used to console himself that the Hippodrome was so big that the audience could never make out the words anyway. It was at this time that he was told to write a number for a Japanese singer who had been engaged at the Hippodrome. He grudgingly came up with lyrics borrowed from the story of Puccini's Butterfly, and much to his chagrin, the words were combined with a refrain of what at the time seemed to him a terrible tune.
"Four butterflies, meet the blossoms waiting. Four butterflies, pick it up, for she loved him so. The moments pass into hours, the hours pass into years, and as she smiles through her tears, she murmurs low. The moon and I know that he'll be faithful. I'm sure he'll come to me by and by. But if he don't come back, and then I'll never sigh or cry. I just must die. Four butterfly." Now, if you want to try it. "Four butterfly, neath the blossoms waiting."
The melody Golden disliked so intensely became the musical vogue of the nation. It was strummed, hummed, whistled, wept, and played by a million pianos, ukuleles, and tenors in the land. The U.S. went butterfly mad about a tune its lyricist despised.
Thank you.
Poor Butterfly was a song written by a man whose musical education began in Wauseon, Ohio, when his mother bought him a fiddle and a professor was hired to give him lessons at 25 cents apiece. After 8 lessons, the boy was convinced there was nothing more for him to learn. He told himself he could play any tune he wanted, and since he didn't want to play any other tunes anyway, he turned to writing songs. With greater success, incidentally, than George, his office boy in later years.
I remember at one time I had a streak of thinking I might be a lyric writer. And he read my lyrics and said they didn't have any kick at the end, which was the whole purpose of a lyric, and dissuaded me from that career.
Producer, playwright, actor, director, George Abbott.
When I first met John Golden, I was employed only as an actor, but I was an aspiring playwright. And I took him some of my plays. And he read them and encouraged me, but didn't buy any plays. And then he suggested that I come and work in his office. And I think my salary was $15 a week. I had various jobs. Sometimes I sat at the front desk and turned away actors. And then eventually I became kind of a sub-casting director and assistant playwright. At the time, John Golden was doing a play called Three Wise Fools. At the time I worked in his office. He didn't think that Austin Strong was working enough at the rewrites. So he would goad the poor man by giving me scenes to write. And I, being very ambitious, would turn out a scene, undoubtedly a very bad one, in short order. And this would make Austin turn to it and write a better scene. And that's how they got many of the rewrites on Three Wise Fools done. All his life, he remained a kind of a warm friend, and it was always a pleasure to see him and go back over the old days in which he called me his office boy.
Three Wise Fools, given impetus by office boy Abbott, turned into one of the three most successful comedies Golden produced, his close friend Winchell Smith again employed as director. That same year, 1918, Golden heard about a vaudeville sketch that had been playing in the hinterlands for more than 20 years. With Smith as his collaborator, he brought it to Broadway.
Lightning is considered one of the minor classics of the American theater.
Theater historian John Gassner.
You might call it old-fashioned in its contrived plotting, but it is new-fashioned, it is universal in its feeling for character and its fundamental good nature. I doubt very much whether it will ever really date.
Lightning, John Golden's most successful production, held the record for the longest run on Broadway until Abie's Irish Rose came along. But if Winchell Smith saw possibilities in Three Wise Fools and Lightning, he saw nothing but disaster in Austin Strong's Seventh Heaven. And Smith wasn't alone. No one had enough faith in this melodrama of the Parisian underworld to back it financially. So, in May of 1922, Golden opened the play, deciding, he said, to make my heaven alone. The play brought stardom to a young girl who became one of the finest emotional actresses of the American theater.
I learned perhaps a little something about the philosophy of love from John.
Miss Helen Menken.
We were rehearsing in Seventh Heaven, and there was a bureau, there was a stove, there was a table, and I had the props in my hand, and all of a sudden I stopped and I said, John, something's wrong. Something's wrong with this set. I can't play this scene. Where's the bed? He said, bed? Bed? What do you mean? What are you thinking of? He said, are you thinking of a bed, Zerst? Or are you thinking of Chico? Or are you thinking of Chico and then a bed? I said, I don't know, John. You've got me all confused. I don't know what I'm thinking about. He said, that's exactly what I want the audience to do. I want them to do a little work. I want them to think and let their imagination take flight. You can play a play without any scenery in a backdrop. Don't you understand what I'm getting at, Helen? If you have that bed there continually, 24 hours a day, that's not very graceful in life. What is graceful? It's an old cliche. Superimpose the bed. Sex, if you will. With a bit of chiffon, it'll last. It'll never become a bore.
The clean plays of John Golden. He used to say they were his crown and his cross, his punishment and his reward, his blessing and his curse. They brought me the sneers of the sophisticates, he said, the jibes and veiled innuendos of erudite critics. But they also brought applause from the many who approved of his policies. And one of those was his oldest friend, Bernard Baruch.
I've met many men in my life, men whose friendship I've cherished, but none whom I have valued more than John Golden. It was principally not because of his mind, but more of his character, but particularly of his heart. He was one of the most compassionate men I ever knew, and his desire not to show, alone to show his love for his fellow man, people in his own profession, but it covered the widest field indeed. He not alone endeavored and always succeeded in producing clean plays, but he always did it with a clean mind and a clean heart.
The very phrase, clean play, Golden used to say, is harmful to the box office. Even when you're a kid, soap is your enemy. He produced clean plays, he would tell you, because he liked them, because he was sure there was profit in them. There are, he claimed, more people who want the wholesome than the unwholesome in life. His assistant for 19 years, Clarence Van Sapp, recalls...
He had an aversion to any off-color jokes and to bad language on the stage. All his productions, he felt, should be put together so that a mother could bring a child to see it.
And among the plays he turned down because they didn't pass his personal censorship were some that later became successful.
I think one of the last that we turned down that he liked somewhat but didn't particularly care for the love angle as it was written was The Rainmaker. I don't believe The Rainmaker was a smash hit, but it didn't lose any money.
When one critic blasted a Golden production as typical of the innocuous type of play Golden always puts on, he ran to the nearest dictionary, and there was just a trace of smugness in his report to the cast that the word innocuous is defined as harmless or non-poisonous.
But there was one thing. Even if a play got bad notices, he never ranted at the critics. He called them performance for pennies. They had to give a show, and he figured that they were necessary to the theater, and that a play must stand on its own merits.
On the subject of playwrights, he said he had great sympathy for the unknown playwright who was trying to climb a long, hard hill. But, he added, he seldom found unsolicited plays to be of use to him. And so, according to his secretary, Alice Cook...
In the front office, we had a sign, Mr. Golden does not accept unsolicited plays. Bobby had this pet theory that he'd love to develop authors, and he got subscriptions from practically everywhere for that. That was a pet of his. And this ELT, the Equity Library Theaters, he started and paid for that himself out of his own pocket. For 2 years. Now I believe that's going on to be quite a thing in taking care of children's theater.
The hardest job in the world, he said one time, is to write a play for the American theater. In all the jobs of modern industry, man is able to measure the value of what he's doing step by step. There are gauges and tests and statistical analyses to go by at every point. But in the theater, you're in the dark.
Many years ago, he sent me a play. Well, I thought it was a dreadful play.
The critic is Miss Helen Hayes.
But he was most anxious that I should appear in it. And after saying no by the telephone and by letter and other means, he finally persuaded me to come down to have lunch with him in his office. He thought that if we talked it over face to face, I might be won. I did so. And the luncheon table was set in his office with... a nosegay by my plate and a bucket with champagne by the table, and it was all very festive. I still wasn't won, except by his warm and adorable personality, and I had a very good time. But at the end of lunch, he finally, as a last resort, I suppose, took me to the window, and he pointed up the street there, up 44th Street, where his office was, and he said, "You see that theater up there? Well, I own that theater. And if you do this play, I'll bring it into that theater, and I'll change the name. How would you like to have a theater named after you? How would you like to see that sign there in front of that theater read?" And he pointed to the sign, and he went down the sign. H-E-L-E-N-H-A-Y. How do you spell your name, with or without the E? Well, I confess that it was with the E. And he said, "Well, let me see now. There isn't room on that sign for the E."
It took others with wider marquees to fit the E into the lights of Broadway. But what may not be as generally known as the naming of a theater in honor of Miss Hayes is that the play she called Dreadful was written by John Golden under another name. Written in his office, where he sat behind an ancient desk on which stood golden telephones and inkwells, and into which he put the souvenirs of 80 colorful years. Among those souvenirs was an old cigar box.
He brought out that box of souvenirs once when I went to his office.
The voice of the most recent of the great performers who played at the John Golden Theater. The voice of Victor Borge.
I was to meet him for lunch. And he took out a moldy-looking, ordinary piece of brownish candy wrapped in cellophane. And then he said, "Now tell me, Victor, you have traveled all over the world and seen all sorts of treasures and collector's items. What would you do with a thing like this?" My first answer was to consign it to the garbage pail. But then he told me the story of how he had acquired it. It seems he was at the White House the weekend President Roosevelt returned from the Tehran conference. And he was dazzled by the souvenirs the president had brought back. Moroccan leathers, embroidered slippers, jeweled boxes. Mr. Golden was particularly thrilled when the president invited him to choose one of the souvenirs for himself. He looked over the exotic display and finally chose the least impressive looking of the doll, a small box of quite ordinary looking candy. Its significance to him was the romantic fact that it had been made specially for King Ibn Saud of Saudi Arabia, who had personally given it to President Roosevelt, who now had personally given it to John Golden. And so, he had kept this candy all wrapped up in his regal cellophane in his desk drawer for almost 10 years. When he finished the story of its history, he said, "Now tell me, Victor, what can I do with this? A gift from a king to a president to me. I can't display it. It doesn't look like anything. I can't eat it. It is probably rotten after all these years, but I certainly can't throw it away. What can I do with it?" Suddenly his face took on the mischievous boyish twinkle he had to the end of his more than 80 years, and he said, "I know what I'll do. I'll give it to you." And so, now I am the proud but bewildered owner of a gift from a king to a president to John Golden to me. I cannot display it. I cannot eat it. And I certainly cannot throw it away. Perhaps someday, when I am 80 years old and in a position to give lofty advice to a rising young actor, I will bequeath him my golden treasure.
Biographies and Sound, featuring tonight the story of John Golden, will continue in just a moment. NBC News is honored to acknowledge the receipt of a double award for Biographies and Sound from Radio and TV Daily on behalf of the radio and television editors of the United States. For highest honors, the award reads, in the field of radio documentaries during 1955 and for the best transcribed series of 1955. Now, a brief pause for station identification. And now, NBC News continues its presentation of Mr. John, the Golden Story. Here again is your narrator, Kenneth Banghart.
John Golden was never quite sure how many songs he had written since the day he realized there was money in setting rhymes to music. He collaborated with such composers as Irving Berlin, Oscar Hammerstein, and Victor Herbert, and with at least one personage normally not associated with writing songs. Playwright and actor Elliot Nugent tells the story.
We did a play together. He and I co-produced a play, which I had written, called A Place of Our Own. John was especially friendly to this play because it had to do with the period of Woodrow Wilson, and he had had an association with Mr. Wilson, was a great admirer of his. In fact, Mr. Wilson once allowed him to publish a song using some of Wilson's words with Mr. Golden's music. He was very proud of this, and rightly so.
It wasn't long before Golden was being asked to write scores for musical comedies, his reputation stemming from such ditties as this one.
When this dancing phase first started, I was nearly broken hearted to discover that my shoes were full of feet. They had no sense of rhythm, couldn't do a darn thing with them, but just walk around and go and find a seat. When I'd hear the music playing, something seemed to keep on saying, well, it's do like that, but one foot's always late. I knew how I should do it, but I never could get to it, for my mind and feet would not associate. But now I've learned it grand, I can dance to beat the band, but there's one thing I can never understand. I can dance with everybody but my wife. She's out of step from start till we get through. The trouble is that she insists on leading me, which she does in every other thing we do. With others, I'm as graceful as a young gazette, but with her, it's just a struggle and a strife. I can dance as good as Castle, but with her, it's just a wrestle. I can dance with everybody but my wife.
Along came a musical called Chin Chin and the Predicament. During a lull in the proceedings, the hero was supposed to sing a song at the girls in the chorus, but no song had been written for him. Upon orders from the producer, Golden went to work in what he later described as a little room filled with plumbing fixtures adjoining the producer's office. Within 30 minutes, he submitted Goodbye, Girls, I'm Through, a song that earned him thousands of dollars. With the money, as a matter of fact, with the first $3,000 of it, he set himself up as an independent Broadway producer. His first venture turned to the right. It brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars. But to get back to the people around John Golden, a fascinating assortment of folk ranging from Woodrow Wilson to Lillian Russell, from King Leopold of the Belgians to FDR. Mrs. Roosevelt put it this way.
His plays were chosen for the birthday plays for my husband, and he came down, and my husband grew very fond of John Golden, and they used to reminisce about the theater in my husband's youth. I remember once he brought the play, This is the Army, up to Hyde Park so my husband could see it, and improvised stage props and curtains and everything else in the library at Hyde Park. But he was particularly happy because somebody didn't come. And it was just a casual walk on the stage, and he got me to do it. And he just gloried in that from that time on. I think he was one of the people who got more joy out of life from what he could give than anyone I ever met. He was always thinking of things that he could give people. I remember once he came to my new apartment, which I was new then, but which I'm now living in, and looked out at my garden. He didn't say anything. I had a little garden at the back, and I hadn't really had time to do much about it. And I came in 2 days later and discovered that the gardener that looked after his things in the country had been sent in and, without my doing anything at all, was replanting my garden. I wasn't quite sure that I liked his choice of flowers, but I was very grateful for the kind thought of Mr. Golden. He was just a sweet person.
I've worked for Mr. Golden for 19 years.
His assistant, Clarence Van Sapp, recalls,
he was a difficult man to work for because he was a perfectionist. He expected perfection of himself and of all those about him. There were many anecdotes told about him, and many of them were, to be frank, not complimentary to Mr. Golden. But he enjoyed them regardless. I remember his telling me that early in George Kaufman's career as a director, he hired him to produce a play for him at the Little Theater. He called George in and said, "Now, George, I'm going to give you this job directing a play. I want you to block it out and put it on. You can do what you want to with it. And when you feel that you need me, you call for me and I'll come down." Well, Mr. Golden was never known for his patience. He waited a week, and he began to become fretful about it, wondering how it was going. He said, "Well, I'll give him a few more days." He waited 10 days. Still had not been called by Mr. Kaufman. He waited 12 days, and finally, he could no longer stand it. He jumped up and said, "I think I'll go down on the stage and see how George is getting along." Well, when he arrived, Mr. Golden, in his usual affable, booming way, said, "George, I don't like the way you've been ignoring me." To which Mr. Kaufman calmly replied, "You don't, John? How would you like to be ignored?"
On heartless Broadway, in a world where kindness is often rare, John Golden is remembered for being the exception to the every-man-for-himself rule.
He was a bluff and hearty man, and one wouldn't ordinarily think of him as being particularly sensitive to the feelings of others, but he was.
Again, Elliot Nugent.
I know when I returned to New York after my first visit to California, when I had first gone out there to work in motion pictures, I'd been gone for a year and a half, and I arrived back in New York late one evening, and the next morning I was walking down 7th Avenue on my way to the Lambs Club, and I anticipated a friendly reunion with some of my friends. The first person I happened to encounter on the street was John Golden. And as we passed, I said in a very cheery way, "Hello, Mr. Golden." And John said, "Hello." Kept on going. I suppose I looked a little crestfallen unconsciously, so I kept on going too. And about halfway down the block, when I'd almost forgotten about having passed him, I heard this booming voice saying, "Hey, Elliot, hey, Nugent." So I turned around, and here was John Golden coming back toward me. I retraced my steps, and we met up again. He said, "You've been out in California, haven't you?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Quite a while." I said, "Yes, about a year and a half." He said, "Well, I just realized after I passed you, I got thinking there was a kind of a funny look on your face. You want somebody to say, 'Hello, how are you? It's nice to see you back in New York.'" I said, "Well, yes, that's just about the way I feel." So he gave me a big slap on the back and said, "Well, hello, how are you? I'm glad to see you back in New York." When I think of him now, I would like to meet him again walking down 7th Avenue. I'd be glad to see him back in New York.
In 1909, Golden married Margaret Hestrick, an actress. They had no children of their own, but the gates of their estate in Bayside, Long Island, were never closed to the youngsters of the vicinity. Among those closest to him there was radio and TV performer Jinx Falkenberg McCrary.
Yes, it was as a neighbor that we knew John Golden best, because we lived just 10 minutes away from John, where he had his headquarters in Bayside, Long Island. You know, this man who never had any children of his own turned over his estate in Bayside to the Police Athletic League. And he had built for the PAL 7 great baseball diamonds. So there were hundreds of kids every afternoon playing baseball right in his home grounds. I remember so well the 80th birthday, the last birthday that John Golden ever celebrated, when all of Bayside and a great part of New York came out to pay tribute and to wish him a happy birthday. Thousands of people came. So many came into his home in Bayside that some of the neighbors couldn't get in. So John said, "Let's go out." So we got into his car, the top was down, and we drove very slowly through the main street of Bayside, a very small street, but filled with people, with the storekeepers, with the families, with the mothers and fathers and grandmothers and children. And all these people knew John well enough to call him John. And he turned to me and he said, "You know, Jinx, I've had a lot of applause in my life. I've heard it. But nothing has ever moved me as deeply as this does." Later on that very hot June afternoon, when most of the people had gone back to their communities. And John Golden and I sat there, and we looked over his 7 baseball diamonds. And I asked him if the noise didn't ever disturb him, those hundreds of children out there playing and sometimes screaming and maybe fighting a little bit over a score. And I asked him when he was working, composing, or planning a production, if that didn't bother him. And John Golden said very quietly and very simply, "That's the last sound I ever want to hear, the sound of children playing and laughing in my backyard."
It was as a poor songwriter that Golden first saw the 21-acre estate in Bayside, the spacious grounds, the private beach, and the palatial house. To be rich enough to own a place such as this. A few years later, the success of Lightnin' and Seventh Heaven turned a dream into reality. John Golden bought the place and moved in.
He was responsible for my first meeting with Gertrude Lawrence, and he often claimed credit for being at least partly responsible for our marriage in 1940.
Once more, Richard Aldrich.
It all started when I talked to him back in 1939 about trying out a new play called Skylark at my summer playhouse on Cape Cod. Mr. Golden, or rather Mr. John, as Gertrude and I like to call him, liked summer theaters, and he agreed, providing he could persuade Miss Lawrence to return from Florida, where she was vacationing. He sent her a telegram, and she replied with the query, "What is a summer theater?" She had never played in one. She had never heard of one. Mr. John told her what a summer theater was, and replied that she would be very happy on the Cape if she would consent to come. We all agreed on terms, and everything was set for a particular week in August. Then a series of telegrams began to arrive. "I must have a house with so many bedrooms. I must have a house on a beach or a lake. I must have a special room for my chauffeur, another for my maid. I must have a dressing room of such and such a size. I must have hot and cold running water. Will my dog be happy, or are there too many ticks?" So many telegrams came that I began to get annoyed. "Look here," I wrote to Mr. John. "What goes on? I've handled stars like Ethel Barrymore, Jane Cowell, and Ina Clare, and I've never had as many troubles as I'm having now." He broke down and told the truth. He was the culprit. Miss Lawrence knew nothing about the telegrams. He was just trying to make sure she would be happily received. He felt that stars should be treated as stars, that they should have the best of everything. For Gertrude, he would have 2 or 3 small dressing rooms knocked together into one. Air conditioning, radio, a telephone, everything to make her comfortable. Her dog, Mackie, a West Highlander, was most important to Gertrude's happiness. So he always saw to it that the dog was well taken care of and fed during every evening performance.
I first got to know him well when I starred in his production of theater, the Guy Bolton dramatization of the Somerset Maugham novel.
Again, Cornelia Otis Skinner.
From the first day of rehearsal, I was aware of his kindness, his expansive, warm nature, and his inspiriting optimism. We had need of that optimism, for at the tryout in Washington, the show was lacerated by the critics to the extent that would have prompted a less courageous producer to close in 1 week. Not so John Golden. He had faith in the play, faith in the cast. It was a contagious faith which kept us all going during the period of revisions and further tryouts. And the happy result was a successful New York run and a long road tour. But I remember his relations with his actors because they were those of consideration and friendly interest. If anyone were ill, John was around personally to see what he could do. When my own father died, John, without my even suggesting it, closed the play for 2 days, although at the time it was doing capacity business. To me, John Golden typified all that was best and endearing in the manager of the old school. In his respect for tradition, his love of theater, his great sense of showmanship, and his charmingly candid awareness of being himself a big personage on Broadway. His very loquaciousness, which could at times even approach garrulity, was in the style of the old school. But it was always, always interesting and highly amusing. Yet there was nothing backward about this amazing man. His interest in the modern theater was keen. He kept abreast of politics, took part in civic projects, went zestfully in for countless national, community, and charitable activities, and always, always he had time for his friends. For his great quality was a zest for living and affection for his fellow man. In the words of Lord Tweedsmuir, he maximized his life.
In 1924, Golden went to Hollywood to sink a shaft, he thought, into the gold fields of the infant picture industry. It was like a dream, he told his friends when he returned to New York. The picture business is as much like play producing as louse exterminating is like lion hunting. The differences are basic. And then there was radio.
The first time I met John Golden, established, I've always felt our future relationship.
That veteran of broadcasting, Mary Margaret McBride.
I'd invited him sight unseen to be on my radio program, and as he always told it, I turned up in the studio about 3 seconds before we were to go on the air. I found him nervously fingering an enormous sheaf of notes, and according to him, without saying how do you do or even introducing myself, I swooped down crying, "What have you got there?" "What I'm going to talk about," he answered, trying to hold on to his precious papers. He always declared that I grabbed the whole business out of his hand and threw it on the floor. And in the background, as we went on the air, the listeners could hear John Golden muttering to himself as he unavailingly scrambled about trying to pick up the pieces. I was right, of course, about his not needing notes, but though he appeared with me again and again, he always came fully prepared with lengthy reminders of what he wanted to say, and I always took them away from him and tore them up before his eyes. He invariably fumed and fretted that now he wouldn't be able to talk at all. As a matter of fact, nothing could have been farther from the truth. Once after I began doing my broadcast from my own apartment, I really had to lock Mr. Golden up in the kitchen so as to keep him quiet long enough to get in my commercials. He had a notion that he could improve on my way of doing them, but his methods were a little bit unorthodox. Right in the middle of my praise of an ice cream or a cleaner, he'd suddenly demand, "What's that anyway? Is it really any good?" Sniffing as if he were smelling something not quite first quality.
But, says his secretary Alice Cook,
one thing he did love was publicity.
And his assistant Clarence Van Sapp has an example of how this masterful sense of what to do at the right time saved Three's a Family.
We finally opened at the Longacre. And we got split notices. Everybody was gloomy, sitting around the office with long faces, but not Mr. Golden. He said, "I'm going to see what I can do about this. I love this play. It's funny. We're at war. People need humor." He says, "I'm going to fight for it." And fight for it he did. And one of his schemes was the printing of a postcard that said something to the effect that, if you like Three's a Family, write and tell your friends, and we'll stamp and mail the cards. And so that we would get good audience reaction, all the seats in the rear of the theater, the Longacre, he filled with soldiers and servicemen who were in town. And it was this word-of-mouth publicity that eventually made our play catch on. He was the most fascinating man I ever met. And he certainly was one of the last of the old-time producers who worked in every department of the plays that he produced. And who never used outside capital. If he had faith in a play, he put his own money into it. And if his friends wanted to buy in, he refused to let them because he said it was his gamble and he didn't want to feel, if the play failed, that he had lost money for his friends.
And now the final chapter. John Golden died of a heart attack on June 17th last year. His imprint on the memories of those around him still vivid.
The last time I saw John Golden was at the luncheon he gave for five of what he called his favorite women. Mrs. Roosevelt,
the wife of the mayor of New York City, Mrs. Wagner, Helen Hayes, Dorothy Shaver, and me, and I'm proud that he asked me. It was a gay, moving occasion, with him anxiously worrying whether we should have our orchids at the beginning of the meal or at the end, and solicitously ordering little extras that he was afraid we might not know about. I wish I had seen him the day he came to my apartment with a huge bunch of lilies of the valley, which he left with my doorman, along with a note which said, "I picked these with my own hands in my garden this morning when the dew was on them."
Almost to the very end, says actor Donald Cook, Golden was surrounded by work.
He was always so active, even in his later years when he was very often laid up. His mind was working all the time. He always had plans. He never accepted any pessimistic attitude. As a matter of fact, I have in my possession now a letter which he wrote to me 2 days before he died. And the letter was setting up an appointment for me to come in and talk to him about a new play.
But to those closest to him, the man of limitless energy began to show signs of listlessness.
Towards the end, when he got very sick and nothing seemed to matter, of course he couldn't sleep at night and he used to watch television and listen to the radio. He was quite a fan on the radio, and he was always fussing about radios. Something was the matter with his radio. The thing was that he'd doze off to sleep during the time, and then he couldn't hear it, and he'd imagine something was wrong. And towards the end, he got so very weary, he said, "Alice, nothing matters." He said, "Don't ever get old."
This, then, was Mr. John, and this was the Golden Story, 1874 to 1955.
The great thing about the theater is that it can indulge in so many talents and personalities. But there are very few showmen. John Golden was a showman. A showman who passes the torch of living theater from one generation to another. And so he has become part of our theater heritage.
Goodbye, girls. I'm through. Each girl that I have met, I say goodbye to you without the least regret. I've done with all flirtation. You've no more fascination. There's but one to whom I'm true. Goodbye, girls. Goodbye, girls. Goodbye, girls. I'm true.
You have been listening to another specially transcribed feature of NBC's Biographies in Sound series, to be presented every week at this time. Script and editing by Joseph Dembo. Production, Gloria Kay. Your narrator was Kenneth Banghart. Prepared under the supervision of Arthur Wakely for NBC News.
Let's visit with McGee and Molly tonight on the NBC Radio Network.